Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to These Times. I'm Tom McTague.
And I'm Helen Thompson.
Over the past few weeks, we've been talking about the geopolitics of Europe, the Middle East and Russia. While in the news, there's been a lot of discussion about fertility rates, population growth and immigration. So what we wanted to do this week was to try and combine the two, bring them together to discuss the geopolitics and economics of demography. And we're really excited that we've got Dr. Paul Morland, a former senior member of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, author of Human Tide, which is on my bookshelf, and the author of the upcoming book, No One Left, Why the World Needs More Children. Welcome, Paul.
Hello.
The question we're going to ask with Paul this week is quite simple. Why does population matter?
For years, two things have been true. The world's population is increasing and its birth rate is falling. South Korea already had the world's lowest birth rate, but this week, new data showed it had fallen further. Japan also recorded a new low.
The decline of births is in a state of crisis. I believe we are at a time when we have to take urgent measures.
With more than 1.4 billion people, India is now the world's most populous country.
To the US birth rate, which has been in decline now for years, and now a new survey suggests that this trend is likely to continue, if not accelerate. We take a look by the numbers. The US birth rate has dropped for the sixth straight year in a row, and except for one year, has been steadily declining.
By 2050, the number of people over 65 will triple.
So, Paul, I think we're going to start with the history of demographics to get a sense of why it's so important for the world today, to understanding the world that we live in. And then in the second half, we're going to turn to sort of projecting forward to why it's going to shape the future world. So let's start with the history. Could you give us a sort of brief explanation of why it's been so important to shaping the world that exists today?
Well, history is the history of human beings, and demography is the study of human beings from a quantitative point of view. If you're trying to raise an army, the number of people you can raise matters. If you're trying to run an economy or trade with other countries, the size of your economy will very much be determined by the number of people. Now, there are, of course, other things that matter in history. Nobody denies economics is important. Power is important, although power to some extent flows from both demography and economics. Ideology matters. People, individual leaders matter. So there are loads of complicated factors in history, and demography is only one of them. But what I argued in The Human Tide, and I believe, is that as a factor in both creating the past and shaping the future, it's underappreciated and understudied. And that's what I'm trying to address.
You quite persuasively in The Human Tide, Paul, talk about a population revolution, and that population revolution beginning really, if we want to put a year on it, to be precise, around 1800, and in a particular country, the country in which we're talking, Britain. Can you tell us how it was that population revolution first changed, in some sense, the whole world to come. And then we want to go back and like talk about the particular impact it had on the kind of country Britain was and what that meant for Europe and Britain's empire.
Of course. I think to understand this, you really need to understand the prehistory or the pre-modern. I always talk about pre-modern, modern and post-modern in demography. We may come to the modern to the post-modern, but the pre-modern to the modern is really around the year 1800, perhaps slightly earlier in Britain. Now, the history of the world demographically before that is really interesting. All sorts of things happen. Plagues come along, years of good harvest and technology. Population goes up, population goes down. But the general pattern, which Malthus correctly associated with the past and the present up to his time, more or less, is that if a population expands, if the average couple has four or six children, each cohort doubles and doubles and doubles again, the pressure is impossible for the world to support. And around the time of Julius Caesar, there were 250 million people in the world, right? Imagine that had doubled, doubled and doubled again. That's just two children per couple each century. You'd have had hundreds of billions around the year 500, thousands of billions, billions of billions. I mean, do the math, as our American friends say. And that could never have happened. Well, what's the mechanism by which it didn't happen? People did, on average, have five or six children, but at least a third of them, a quarter or a third, would die before they reached the age of one. Two-thirds would not normally reach the age of reproduction. And therefore, the population took 2,000 years from Julius Caesar to Queen Victoria to quadruple. Now, that quadrupling is a lot, but 2,000 years is a very long time. There are countries that see their population in modern conditions, today's conditions, quadruple in 50 years. So there were moves forward, moves back. The classic case in Europe was the Middle Ages, advances in technology, a certain sort of political stability that meant the population flourished, and then along came the Black Death, and it was pushed back for many, many years. The Hundred Years' War led to, certainly in France, a decline in population in certain areas, and then the 30 Years' War in Germany. So Malthus's point was, left alone, human population would double, 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 double. It couldn't do that. And if it didn't get hit by wars or diseases, it would get hit by famine, because the world simply didn't have that capacity to feed endless numbers of people. And so the world was always banging up against a sort, well, human populations were always banging up against some sort of frontier. And if they got knocked back a long way by something like the Black Death, then conditions got better, because humans were living a long way from that frontier. Their living standards improved. They kept more of their children alive. And eventually the population would go back up to that frontier. And that frontier moved only very slowly. And if we didn't control our fertility, and there weren't very easy ways of controlling it in Malthus's day, then we'd endlessly be banging up against that frontier and most people would live in misery. And that, for Malthus, was an argument against Enlightenment ideas that somehow social, economic or political regimes could alleviate poverty and create some kind of utopia. That's the background to Malthus's thinking. And that pretty much was the world everywhere until Britain got out of what we call the Malthusian trap. And the way it did that was through the use of fossil fuels, through the Industrial Revolution. It unknowingly, in a sense, created a global system whereby vast areas of Canada, the United States, and Australia opened up to what were then modern agricultural techniques, with the technology of agriculture, with the settlement of European peoples, with railways, with steamships. And the whole world, in a way, became available to the people of Britain and eventually the people of Europe to feed itself. And that meant a huge drop in the mortality rates. More children could live. People lived longer and better lives. There was also an improvement in medicine. There was an improvement in public health. And all of this meant that in the 19th century, mortality rates in the most advanced countries, first of all Britain and then throughout the rest of Europe, mortality rates fell. Now, as long as that happens, while people are still having large families, the population will grow and grow and grow. And so Britain in the 19th century almost quadrupled its population, whilst at the same time exporting huge numbers of people for settlement all the way from San Francisco to Adelaide. So there was this extraordinary explosion of population and emigration, and at the same time the population at home grew very, very fast. Nothing like that had really happened before.
And would you say then that it's the use of coal that is fundamental in propelling the Industrial Revolution to that change?
Without coal, the whole thing wouldn't have got going. Of course, other technologies were required to which you could apply coal, like the steamships, like the railways, which could bring the food from afar. The coal alone wasn't enough, but the coal was absolutely foundational. And then eventually it was replaced by oil, and it may in due course be replaced by renewables. I mean, that's another subject. But it was the energy breakthrough, really, that the technological energy breakthrough, which meant that huge areas could be settled and send back food in exchange for industrial products which were made in Britain.
So if that had happened somewhere else, Poland, say, or Turkey or Greece or wherever, and there was there would have been a mass growth in the population of Poles or Greeks or Turks, and they would have populated the world and they would have become the dominant power. That's how you see the sort of the geopolitics of the demographics that you've explained.
Well, that's a very good question, and history is a complex science. And if we think about why Britain was the first out of the Malthusian trap and the first to industrialise, there's a huge literature and a huge debate among historians. Might China have got there before? Mm. That in some ways was more likely. Poland, and Poland certainly has a lot of coal. Turkey, I'm not so sure. But both of those areas had certain disadvantages. Britain had the advantage of being a maritime nation, a great naval tradition already, and on the edge of Europe ready to. So there are many complex factors. But some people say it's got to do with British traditions or English traditions, particularly of law, of politics, and property rights. Others say it's particularly to do with the climate in Lancashire and the availability of coal. This is a huge historical debate and a very interesting one. The point I'm making is that whatever the reason for Britain being the first out of this trap, a critical component of it, founded though it was, you're absolutely right, on fossil fuels, on coal, a key component to unlocking that potential was through a massive population expansion. And without that population expansion, Britain would not have been able to settle the British Empire. Of course, the British Empire predates the Industrial Revolution, but it was a very different sort of beast in 1750, say, to in 1900. That colonial settler project, which saw Brits and more generally Europeans spreading out to the wider world, was a critical component and changed the balance of power in the world. So I'm not saying population was a first mover, but it was an absolutely essential transitional factor without which Britain and Europeans more generally would not have been able to dominate the globe and shape the globe as we see it today.
I think that there's a really interesting paradox here, Paul. And again, as you've already said, I mean, in a way that it's a historical subject way beyond what we can, you know, tease out between ourselves in this discussion. Because clearly, if you look at it in terms of global power, that Britain has become the most significant power in the world probably in the second half of the 18th century. And it's going to lose one part of that in terms of the American colonies after 1776. And then Britain becomes a different kind of imperial power in the 19th century, in which, as you said, it's exporting population to different parts of the world, probably most significantly maybe Australia. That hasn't been the case earlier.
Certainly Canada.
Yeah, Canada too.
And indeed still to the United States.
But it is, but at the same time, obviously, the population exporting to them, going to the United States has already started, and lost in some sense. But I think one of the things that's interesting is that you could argue that it's in the 19th century that Britain, with this new population, asserts itself as a European power significantly more than had previously been the case. So it's been successful in fighting the French, say, particularly in the long term, perhaps most consequentially in India, but you wouldn't say it's the most important European power in the 18th century. And one of the things that I think is really interesting that I learned from reading The Human Tide is the ways in which what happens in France in the 19th century is very different than what happens in Britain in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And then you get this French anxiety about German population, German anxiety about Russian population. And I wonder if you could just talk us through that story.
Yes.
So how is the comparative power in Europe changing as the different countries have different demographic experiences in the 19th century?
So we talked about Britain, and Britain was first out of the trap, as it were. France is a very interesting case. France traditionally had by far the largest population in Europe, with the exception of Russia, which is a special case, until relatively recently, not really part of the European system. That was sort of Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, during the course of the 18th century. But before that, and of course, Russia was a much more agricultural country and relatively backward, whatever we mean by backward. France was the dominant power in Europe and had by far the largest population other than Russia. And that was the foundation by which French power was built in the 17th century, to some extent in the 18th century and into the Napoleonic era. French population did not grow in the same way Britain's grew. Now, we'll come back to why that was. But that meant there was a serious decline in French power in the course of the 19th century. And famously, after 1870-71, with the Franco-Prussian War, the French felt a great sense of inferiority. They no longer were bordered by a variety of German states, but by one Germany, a united Germany, which was now going through its period of supercharged demographic growth. So the baton, as it were, passed from Britain to Germany. Germany was a couple of decades later in terms of that population takeoff, slightly later industrialization, a unified nation with lots of economic opportunity, so a whole variety of reasons. But Germany really got going in the 1870s, 80s and 90s. But already, a Germany under the officership and leadership of Prussia was able to outman and outgun France. So France, in the course of the 19th century, saw a long-term decline in its population relative to the rest of Europe, particularly Britain and Germany. And it's interesting that really entered the French soul. So today, it's quite notable that Macron is happy to talk about demography in a way that British politicians wouldn't be. And I'm quite pleased about that because I'm talking a lot about contemporary demography and people look at me a bit weird and think, well, that's all Orban, that's all Putin stuff. But actually, at least in Macron, we've got a good centrist who is not ashamed to talk about it. So why? So I definitely map the decline of French prowess in Europe, say between 1815 and 1914, and the French dependence on Britain to prop it up in the course of the First World War, as Britain mobilised and became more military and less purely naval, it was able to take over effectively on the Western Front and keep France from being occupied by Germany in, if not 1914, then certainly by 1916. Or 1970. So why was that in France? It's one of those great mysteries. What happened in France is the mortality rate did fall. France was a relatively backward country compared to Germany or Britain in the sense of it was more agricultural, it industrialized more slowly, and that was a problem for France. Mortality rates came down, but the interesting thing is the birth rate in France never really rose that much. They didn't have that mass immigration that Britain had, so you would have thought their population would grow more. But somehow the French seemed to be able to control their fertility in ways that other people either were not able to or not willing to. And it's very hard. A lot of historical work's been done on this. It's very hard to put your finger on it, but it would seem that the French peasantry had an ability, had knowledge, perhaps more effective knowledge of contraception. And we tend to think if something's invented these days, you know, the smartphone, it will go around the world in 80 months, they'll it might be invented in California, they'll have it in Laos in 18 months later. I think there was probably a lot of folk knowledge in France around how to control your fertility. So French families were smaller and the mortality rate came down. The fertility rate also came down. They didn't have that period of very high fertility. If you actually look beneath the surface in France, some very interesting work has been done recently, which shows that that in turn was very much tied with religiosity. So if you look at the areas of France that where the priests refused to accept the revolutionary regime in 1789, and you use that as a proxy for a religious region, the fertility rate remained higher in those places. So there may have been a sort of peasant secularism as well that was not only able but willing to adopt all sorts of means of contraception. Now, it's speculative. The facts are, though, that the population in France didn't grow and French power
declined.
Isn't there
a more straightforward, though, I'm not saying that's not part of the explanation, but a more straightforward explanation is that the French Industrial Revolution happened quite a lot later. The France was a relatively coal-poor country compared to Britain, Germany and Russia. At that time, it was much harder to export or import coal because of the difficulties of moving heavy fuel around. So if you had a late industrial revolution, wouldn't you expect France to be late to the population growth game?
Well, except it was early. I mean, that's what's slightly confusing. Well, so if you, I mean, two things matter, forgetting migration for a moment, mortality and fertility. So the question then is, why was France's population not growing as rapidly as Britain's in the 19th century. And although French life expectancy was shorter and people were dying earlier, it wasn't that much different. So mortality rates fell in France, even though it was a poorer country than Britain and eventually than Germany, and relatively backward because it didn't move into the industrial era very quickly. It did manage to bring its mortality rate down. The story really is in the fertility rate and the fact that that fell, which in fact, the fact it was a more agricultural country, you might have expected the fertility rate to hold up better and longer. But it
does
didn't.
Sound an extraordinary story that there is some kind of folk wisdom in the French peasant mm-hmm. class that allowed them to change history in a way.
That's the best explanation I can find. Now, there may be people listening to this podcast who know much better than me, and I'd love to hear from them. But I've read widely, I've spoken to demographers in various places, and I haven't found a better historical explanation for the extraordinary low fertility rate of France in the 19th century.
Because what interests us on this podcast is obviously the power implications of this. And, you know, I remember reading about the Hundred Years' War and the sort of, what if England had won? What if the English monarchs had taken over? And the answer was, well, it wouldn't have changed anything really, because it wouldn't have been an English takeover of France. It would have ended up being vice versa because of the demographics, because France was so much bigger. The center of power would have remained in Paris. But by the time we get to the 18th century, the 19th century, actually that has changed, and we can stand on our own 2 feet against the French because we are of a similar size, and then we are richer. So the power comes from the number of people as well as
well,
the
wealth. I think it does. And actually, if you go back to the era of Charles II, so the middle of the 17th century, Britain was very much subservient to France. We kind of forget that. We think 100 Years' War, which is so much earlier, the two were in some way parallel. But those were very much wars among Norman aristocrats, effectively, and feudal wars in a way. Once you get to the 17th century, France is the dominant power, and it's got a much, much bigger population than Britain. In the 18th century, Britain starts to catch up, but actually punching well above its weight from a demographic perspective for a whole range of reasons. And then the 19th century, Britain catches up with France demographically as well.
Can we bring Russia in? Because Russia is obviously a country which has pretty significant population growth.
Well, we skipped Germany.
It's true, yeah. Let's go back to Germany.
So Germany was very much like Britain, but as I said, a few decades later, the industrialization arrived later, but Germany was early to implement a sort of primitive welfare state. Mortality rates fell in Germany at the end of the 19th century, an extraordinary population boom alongside an industrial boom. But Germany, like Britain, then by the time of the First World War, was seeing its fertility rates fall. And both countries had a fertility rate not much above 3. So in Britain in the 1860s, women were having 6 or 7 children. By 1914, they were having 3. And Germany caught up quickly in terms of the falling fertility rate. But in the late 19th century, Germany's population boomed. That was very much associated, of course, with the unification, with the rise of German power, the French looking over their shoulders at Germany, and in due course, the Germans started looking over their shoulders at Russia, because by 1914, or even earlier in the decade before, Germany was noticing its fertility rate falling. Russia, meanwhile, was a number of decades behind, so more rural, industrializing from a lower base, but very, very rapidly. And once you get into the sort of 1890s to 1914 period, Russia had a fantastically high fertility rate. It always had Malthusian conditions. But however hard life was for Russian peasants and the early industrial proletariat, it was better than it had been 20 or 30 years earlier. And what you saw was a fall in mortality rates and the Russian population, which had always been big, starting to take off. Part of that extraordinary rousing of the Russian giant that gave nightmares to Bethmann Hollweg and to the German government, and which I think was a very important part. Just as French paranoia about German population haunted Paris, German paranoia about the rise of Russian population haunted Berlin and definitely played into calculations about what was the right time to go to war.
And how does this then play out in the First World War? Because if we were just being obviously demographic determinist about it, we wouldn't expect Russia to be on the losing side of the First World War. So it's obviously demographics are interacting with other
questions. Well, it wasn't really on the losing side. It was on the winning side. It had just jumped ship before the end of the conflict.
Well, it was in losing in relation to the war in Germany, which is
It pretty much lost relative to the Germans. And again, you know, numbers are not the only thing that counts. But if you look at the whole Allied effort to raise forces, and you look at the Central Powers' effort to raise forces, both were very much in proportion to their population. So if we count America out for the moment, coming in 1917, if we look at Germany, Austria, and then we look at Britain, France, and Russia, the sort of major powers in early on, possibly adding Turkey in as well, the ability to raise your forces was very much in proportion to your population, which meant that the Germans were perhaps destined to lose. And particularly when you have the sort of grinding trench warfare that you had on the Western Front, and you have two sides which are of roughly equivalent levels of education, technology, and industrialization. I mean, France was somewhat behind Britain and Germany, but technologically, the two sides were roughly equivalent. But the Allies, as opposed to the Central Powers, had a significant numeric advantage. And if it was going to be two sides grinding against each other on the Western Front, then you could say it was inevitable that Germany would lose. In the East, of course, Russia suffered from all sorts of problems, much worse transport, giving rise to food shortages. So Russia had that extraordinary population growth, but it wasn't advanced quite enough in 1914 to be able fully to take advantage of it.
Well, then about the interwar years, because what's interesting here on your account, Paul, is that what we'd already seen in Britain in those years, as you've described, leading up to the First World War, starts to spread in other European countries. So we see much less rapid population growth during the 1920s and the 1930s. How much do you think that is part of the interwar crises and what becomes a catastrophe of the Second World War?
Well, what you see in Europe in the interwar years is that wave spreading. So there are places like Germany and the more advanced parts of Austria, where you see, or what had been the Austro-Hungarian Empire, where you see fertility rates starting to fall. But down in the Balkans, you're getting the stirrings of modernity and a fall in the mortality rate, the first stage, if you like, of that demographic transition. So the overall effect in Europe is a moving wave, if you like, of stronger population growth moving out of Northwest Europe and towards the Southeast. And then eventually after World War II, it goes global, and that's really the subject of the second half of the human tide. What I think was clear in the 1920s was that the kind of warfare you were going to have was going to be very dependent on large populations, and the way the war was fought in the West was the way people largely assumed it would be fought. And therefore, people were more concerned about population. I'd say two things. I'm more conscious of it. One is that at that stage, you still had very young, unstable, newly industrialized populations in Europe. And that probably had a major contribution to the rise of fascism. People uprooted from their traditions, young, unstable. The other thing is that people were more conscious of the need to grow their populations. And so you saw, before the First World War, there had been French pronatalism, if you like, but you saw with the rise of the dictators, something of an obsession around numbers. And people often think of Hitler and Mussolini as pronatal, which they were. So was Stalin. Stalin was giving out medals to women who had families above a certain size. And I think that was all in the context of understanding that numbers mattered, and that if the continent were headed to another war, the larger number of young people, the larger number of people you could recruit into the army, it was going to be an obvious advantage and actually something you could do something about. Perhaps people had always known that, but the state had become an instrument for encouraging population growth, I suppose you could say, in more and more countries, not in Britain. It seemed to cut against liberalism, didn't cut against liberalism in France, which gets us back to Macron, if you like. But in the dictatorships of left and right, the idea that the state should be determining the biology and therefore the size of the next cohort became a norm.
Well, is liberalism then, British liberalism in that respect, is it just a sort of confidence, really, that the demographics were with us, that push comes to shove, we do have Australia and Canada And we have India as part of the British Empire at that point. And also, the Americans had come to the Allied side in the First World War. That prospect of, 2.5 million American soldiers potentially arriving on the Western Front had tipped the balance on the Allied side. And the same would be true in the Second World War. So it's not that we weren't worried about it or we didn't think about the demographics. We were just confident in our own numbers.
That, I suppose, would be a material explanation as to why in the Anglo-Saxon world or the Anglosphere, people have been and continue to be a little nervous about talking about matters of population. It could be an ideological thing. It could be something inherent about the sort of liberalism we have in Britain with its tradition in Mill, for example, and Bentham, and the idea that the state should have a view on whether or not you have children and how many you have, I think cuts against a certain British liberalism. Now, maybe you're right. Maybe it is deep down because Britain in the 19th century had so much reason to be self-confident on demographic issues that it didn't really have to worry about them.
But it's also the case, isn't it, that the pronatal list, starting with Hitler, that this desire for a much larger population has to go hand in hand with not only conquering land within Europe itself, not on the other side of the world, but actually annihilating the existing populations to do it. This is a terrible version of population.
Yes, and politics. It's a self-contradictory one, which you see in Japan as well. So the Japanese were, on the one hand, in the 1920s and early 30s and towards the period of war, very eager to tell the countries of the West, look, you've gone out and conquered territories for your burgeoning population. We have a burgeoning population. We don't have enough fertile land. We need to get more land to accommodate our population, while at the same time saying we need more people and having some kind of pronatal policy. Similarly, Hitler, on the one hand, said Germany can't exist on this narrow space, this small country. And if people contradicted him by saying, look at this wonderful new science that's coming along, the Haber-Bosch process, for example, which he hated that sort of thing. I mean, Haber was a Jew, so it was obviously some kind of wicked science. But he hated the idea that actually Germany could survive on this narrow space. So on the one hand, he wanted more and more people. And on the other hand, he was insistent that those people needed more space. So it was a kind of territorial demographic supremacism which said we need more people and we need more space and we'll annihilate the people to take over the space. And that's the way a healthy nation will survive. And anything that contradicted it was brushed aside.
Can we, before we turn to the future in the second half, can we just fast forward quickly to the Cold War? And because you have an interesting take in the book about the, how the demographics played out ending the Cold War. Because if you look at Russia in many ways, you think, well, it should have a bigger population than it has now. You know, it's a fertile land. It's absolutely enormous. It has something like, 125, 150 million people in European Russia alone. So why isn't it bigger and why didn't it win?
Well, there's a little bit of a tendency that when you're late in the game to demographic transition, your numbers change in a more extreme manner. I mean, we see that in much of the third world today or the developing world where population growth is far faster than it ever was in Britain in the 19th century. When you're the same with economics. When you're the first industrial power, your growth's quite slow. When you're adopting technologies that already exist, you can grow much more quickly. And Britain didn't grow anything like as fast as China. In Britain's 19, when China got to industrialization, of course, things were already in place that it could adopt very rapidly. So what happened in Russia was they had this period of falling mortality and high fertility and a very rapid growth in the population. And then, of course, the fertility rate began to fall. And it fell rather rapidly in the 20s and 30s, particularly the 30s and post-war. So the population growth was very slow. And in the Soviet economy, a lot of the economic growth was driven not by greater productivity, but just by throwing more resources at the economy. And those resources were normally human resources. So the huge Soviet expansion of the economy was built on a vast rise in the working age population itself based on the earlier population growth. So, you know, all those births, when they start feeding through to the workforce, that's when you get an extraordinary economic opportunity, particularly when that large workforce is having slightly fewer children. So it may be building up problems for the future, but it's able to focus on the workplace, a big cohort of workers. So that's what happened in Russia in the 20s, 30s, 40s. And Russians quickly adopted small family sizes in the 50s and 60s. And what's interesting in Russia, of course, is Russia was, or the Soviet Union as it was then, is such an enormous country that it had within it many different nationalities and many levels of development. And when the Russians were starting to slow down, the minority peoples, particularly Muslim minority peoples in the Caucasus and Central Asia, were starting to see their own mortality rates fall. They were benefiting from the modernity that the Soviet Union in its own way brought to those regions. And in 1970, there was this shocking census. It shocked the Russian Communist Party or the high-ups in the Soviet Union that the Russian share of the population and the Slavonic share generally, including Belarusians and Ukrainians, was starting to fall. And the assumption had always been, just like the British in the 19th century, if you read the literature of people going out to East Africa and thinking, well, white people will settle these areas and they'll dominate them, obviously, because they're more advanced and they didn't put it in these terms, they have a lower mortality rate, and it would be a shame if all the natives disappeared. I mean, that's what you're starting to see in the 1880s. The assumption of the Russians, perhaps less unthinkingly racist in the way it was articulated, was, of course, Russia will expand and expand. And within the Soviet Union, we've got these nice little brother peoples, but they'll always be small and insignificant. But if you look at the numbers, particularly the youngsters, the growing cohorts in the Soviet Union in the 70s and 80s were Uzbeks and Azeris, who continued to have a fertility rate which was on the high side, 5 or 6, and their mortality rates were coming down. And this definitely sapped the self-confidence of the ruling caste. And it's very interesting in Russia. In the Soviet Union, they introduced some pronatal measures. And they said, we will spread these, about 1980s or late Brezhnev period, we will spread these across the country, but we'll start in certain areas. And the Soviet Union had pronatal policies that were particularly focused on Russians and were not spread to the non-Russian population. So if you're looking for examples of what we would today maybe call apartheid of a sort or demographic engineering, the late Soviet Union was a very good example of it.
Interesting. Well, on that, I think we should definitely take a break here and come back and discuss how demographics is going to affect the future after the break.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back, everyone. So we did the first half there talking about the history, and as promised, we're going to turn to the future now. And, you know, Helen and I were talking about this before this episode. And one of the most striking examples of demographic change comes in the developing world in Africa, but also in the Middle East, which is really fascinating, Helen, in particular. I know you're interested in Yemen.
Yeah, I want to just ask you, Paul, about Yemen, because I have to say in preparing for talking to you today, I did some reading on this and I was just flabbergasted at the size of population change in Yemen. 7 million people in 1970, 35 million people now, and that this is the poorest country in the Middle East. It's one of the most water-scarce places in the Middle East. There's a lot of people who are suffering from malnutrition, particularly obviously in the context of the Yemen civil war, which we've talked about several times on this in this podcast, which began back in like 2014. Can you just like talk us through both how things have ended up population wise, what they are, how they are in Yemen, and what you think the implications of it are, not just for Yemen, but for Yemen's geopolitical position in the Middle East?
Well, Yemen is part of Africa from a demographic point of view, interestingly. I mean, I'm not so geographically ignorant to know that it isn't, and that the Red Sea and the Straits of Mamdab come in between. But Yemen, as a rather bit of a backwater within the Middle East, is going through the kind of demographic transition we've talked about. But as I said, the later it happens, it tends to happen on steroids. So, however, the other thing that's very interesting is, remember, this is a pre-modernity was that Malthusian world, high fertility, high mortality, and low population. And then you get into modernity. Mm. And that is that transition when you get some industrialization, you get some healthcare, some public health, some better water. There are a bunch of things you can do that bring down your infant mortality rate particularly. And while your fertility rate stays high, your population booms. And what's interesting is because there's something called a world community today, because there's aid, we find that this is happening earlier in countries' socioeconomic development. So 70, 80 years ago, it would have taken you a level of development, of growth, of industrialization, to start getting to that point where you were able to introduce the programs of public health and water purification, whatever it is that brings down particularly infant mortality. And now these are being spread by the international community very rapidly to much, much poorer countries. So in a country like Yemen, the socioeconomics may still be that people want very, very large families. Women have very poor education. People are quite rural. Incomes are very low. So the fertility rate stays high. But the international community, through its aid and even through the efforts of the governments in Yemen, which have not been very good or successful governments, but you don't have to do all that much with modern technology to bring your mortality rate down. And that's why in Yemen you can grow the population sevenfold in 50-plus years, whereas Britain, cutting its way along in the 19th century with no nice UN agencies to look after children in the inner cities in Manchester, say, it took much longer. It was a much slower process. So what's happened in Yemen, and it's happening in certain African countries too, is you're putting in some quite basic things. But those are very, very effective in bringing down mortality rates. And it's not that people are having bigger families than they used to have in the 1950s or 1850s. It's simply that you're no longer in a position where a third of children are dying before the age of one. I can't tell you off the top of my head what the infant mortality rate is in Yemen. It's quite high, and it's very high compared to Britain or Japan, say, but it's very low compared to where it would have been 50 or 60 years ago. And that's true of most African countries too. The fertility rate has stayed high, not so much in North Africa or South Africa, decreasingly in East Africa, interestingly. But the fertility rate does stay high while the mortality rate comes down really, really rapidly and life expectancies grow. And when people are having six or seven children, instead of two of those children making it through to the age of having their own children, five or six of them will.
Does that explain Yemen in particular? Why then don't we see Iran, a boom population, or, I don't know, Malawi? Because the countries, from my understanding of Africa, that are really growing in population are, say, Nigeria, which seems to fit perfectly with your description of a industrializing country becoming wealthier. Yeah. The size of the families means that the population grows enormously. But Yemen just seems to stand out because it's so different.
Well, take Iran. Iran is a much more industrialized, much more urban country. You can't compare Iran and Yemen in terms of the history, the urbanization, the levels of education. And women in Iran are decisively not wanting to have many children and leading completely different lives to the sorts of lives that women in Yemen are having. But other countries in the Middle East have been on a similar trajectory and have managed to get their fertility rates down. The whole North African littoral, effectively, has a fertility rate of 2 to 3. So high by European standards, but low by their historical standards, because although they're still quite poor countries from Egypt to Morocco, they have a degree of women's education. They have some ability to implement family planning programs. Women want to have somewhat smaller families. They're not in the position of women in Germany or Italy, say, but they're not in the position of women in Yemen. So a lot has to do with literacy and education and urbanisation.
Well, in some senses, it sounds like if you have a strong central government, autocratic government, where you can control these things, you might be pro-natalist in theory, but actually it's better to almost have no government, because the chaotic environment creates the conditions for the demographic boom.
Well, it's quite complicated. If you have no government or very ineffective government like Yemen, what you find is the country doesn't really develop. It stays poor, it stays rural, it stays uneducated, and even if people wanted to have birth control, they would find it hard to get hold of. But nevertheless, in goes the international community, quite rightly, I think, to do the basic aid that brings down mortality rates. So if all you're looking for is a population boom, a sort of broadly chaotic situation which doesn't allow development, but does allow in the international community to assist, particularly with infant mortality and bringing that down, those, I suppose, would be optimal conditions for population growth. Now, then when you have a strong government, it depends what the government wants to do. A strong government can certainly bring down mortality through healthcare and education and encouraging urbanisation. It's quite difficult for a strong central government can bring down fertility rates. But once people get to a certain level of development and education and urbanisation and income, it's very hard for governments to get the fertility rate up, as we're finding in China today.
If we just throw just one last round on Yemen, because I do think it's a fascinating case. It's a place where, as we've said, there's been a civil war since 2014. The Houthis now control about 30% of the territory, 70% of the population. If you go back and look in 2014 about the uprising in Yemen, it's very much tied with the economic situation in Yemen, the removal of fuel subsidy support from the government. And this is a very poor country. It has a big impact when something like that happens. If you think of it also as a place that's water scarce, is it what happens when you have rising population, limited resources, or at least questions about resources, a very young population, and that you would expect the kind of conflict that there's been in Yemen since 2014?
Well, certainly the youth of Yemen makes it a country prone to conflict. In my book, my most recent book, Tomorrow's People, I talk about the Catalonia of George Orwell's day with civil war and anarchy, and the Catalonia of recent years, which had a referendum on independence and chose to leave Spain, and that wasn't respected. No one's died. And I think a lot of has to do with go around Catalonia and you'll see people are sitting, sipping their espressos and worrying about their pensions. They're not hot-blooded youth. So I think there's a very strong correlation between youth and civil war. In terms of resources more generally, one perspective may be that Yemen will come up against some kind of Malthusian frontier, and that it's going to run out of water, or the conflict will kill so many people that the population won't continue to grow. I doubt that myself. I think the international community takes on itself the burdens of those sorts of scenarios. And from a purely technological point of view, we now have quite affordable desalination, for example. Now, I don't think the Houthis are on the verge of asking Israel to come in and help them sort out their desalination plants, but they could do, and the Israelis could do it for them, or the Spaniards could do it for them. So these resource constraints are very often not absolute, and if they were applying the most modern technology, they wouldn't actually constrain their population growth.
What, pulling the camera out of the Middle East, the thing that I've been so surprised about or find almost impossible to get my head around is the numbers that you see in China, in South Korea and Japan. I mean, by some estimates, China is going to halve in population. Japan is rapidly falling. And by some accounts, South Korea will cease to exist as a population. I mean, can you just talk us through these numbers? Because I find them extraordinary.
Well, remember at the start, I said we have pre-modern, modern and post-modern. The pre-modern was the Malthusian. The modern is this process we've talked about. When you get out of that process, so you get to where most of the developed world is and much of the developing world, life expectancy is 70 to 80 or even more, very low infant mortality. The only thing that matters other than migration is what's your fertility rate? Now, if you look at Korea and Israel, for example, they're both very educated, they're both very wealthy, they're both very urban. It's not about that. Israeli women have three times as many children as Korean women. Korean women have, let's say, Korean couples. We have to be careful. It's measured by woman, but we mustn't allow that to cloud the fact that this is a human issue. It's a family issue. It's as much an issue for men as for women. But Korean couples have two-thirds of a child. That means two people becomes two-thirds of a person. Each cohort is a third the size of the last cohort. So this is postmodern. I mean postmodern in the sense that modern was a material process that we've talked about. It was industrialization, it was urbanization. Postmodern is a world in which we've all got long life expectancy. We expect to live at least to our late 70s or well into our 80s. And what really matters is fertility. And what do we and we all have access to contraception. So what are we choosing to do? Mm-hmm. Are we choosing through our culture, driven by our culture, our norms, our religion, a whole range of cultural issues? Are we having three children each? Or are we having two-thirds of a child each or somewhere in between? More and more of the world is shrinking towards or moving towards the Korean. I mean, Korea is an extreme example. But in Britain, we've had below replacement fertility for more than 50 years now, and we are far from the lowest fertility in the developing in the developed world. Italy, it's lower still. Germany, it's lower still. And what that means is rapid aging and eventually population shrinkage, with the possibility in some countries of shoring the system up by migration.
Mm-hmm.
If you were thinking about this, say, in the beginning of this century, or even maybe the 90s, were there any reasons to think that it would be in Japan and South Korea where these issues would be most dramatic?
Yes, I think as early as the 90s, we could see that fertility rates were particularly low in developed East Asian countries. Japan's had a very low fertility rate, not as low as Korea's, but it's been going on for a very long time. And the question then is why? What is it about East Asia that makes it so low, so super low? And I think the answer, it's something I address in my forthcoming book, is that something about modernity drives us towards low fertility. That's not inevitable, but it's a trend. And in the absence of a Islamic Judeo-Christian tradition, an Abrahamic tradition, that seems to happen very fast. A country like Italy, and you couldn't get much more Catholic than Italy, has a very low fertility rate, as has Greece in terms of Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, and lots of Christian countries, and increasingly Muslim countries like Iran, like Lebanon, like Turkey, have low fertility rates. But they get there more slowly. Modernity without rapid arrival of modernity without the existence of an Abrahamic religion seems to be related to very rapid fertility fall. Now, some of your listeners may say, oh, there's lots of Christianity in Korea, and it's true, but it's rather late in the day. It's evangelical, and it's not embedded in their culture in a way that has led to a slower fall in the fertility rates that you see in countries which are traditionally Catholic, Muslim, or in the case of Israel, Jewish.
That's fascinating. We could also say, isn't it, that within Christianity, within Europe, within obviously Christianity isn't limited to Europe, but within the countries of Europe, that we can see differences, Protestant, Catholic, and increasingly Orthodox. As I understand it, it's in Orthodox countries where the fertility rate is falling.
We could see those differences. In the post-war period, the Catholic rates were higher, and then they flipped. And the fertility stars of the more recent decades in Europe were Scandinavia. Actually, Britain wasn't too bad. And France, a Catholic country, but a relatively secular country. What we've seen in more recent years, in the last 5 or 10 years, is even the Protestant countries of Scandinavia and the Northwest European countries more generally have seen their fertility rates slump. And what we've seen in Eastern and Central Europe is they have very low fertility rates, but they're not continuing to fall. And in some ways, they're picking up a little bit, places like Hungary, Romania, and the Czech Republic. Now, that's probably a technical factor known as the tempo effect, which means that the fertility rate that you observe year on year is depressed when women are delaying their childbearing. And when that delay starts to slow, the thing ticks up. And if you actually looked at completed fertility of completed cohorts, it actually doesn't change that much. And when it was down at 1.2, it was probably artificially depressed by that. And it's sort of nodged up in Central Europe towards 1.4, 1.5. But the countries of Central Europe and the Orthodox countries of Southeastern Europe had a much lower fertility rate than Scandinavia, say, a decade or two ago. And that gap has closed as the whole of Europe, and indeed much of the world, is moving ever lower.
So you think that Christianity or religion in general, Abrahamic religion, is like a break on modernity, effect, but we're getting there.
It's a break on modernity so far as the decline of fertility rates are concerned.
But it's
only a holding mechanism, if you like. It needs to be something more if you're going to get your fertility rate back above two.
Why is it a break?
Because there is a tradition of pronatalism and a family, in a way, in Christianity, in Islam and in Judaism, which does not exist at all in Hinduism or Buddhism. So Hinduism's a very interesting case. India is a very poor country. It's made fantastic progress in the last few decades, but it's still very poor. But India's already got its fertility rate down to two. And I suspect it's going to carry on falling quite rapidly in a country which is predominantly Hindu. I think it will fall faster. Compare, for example, Indonesia or the Philippines with Thailand. If you look at where each of those countries is in terms of socioeconomic development, Thai fertility is lower in the absence of the Catholicism you find in the Philippines or the Islam you find predominantly in Indonesia.
Can we just switch back to Europe for a minute? How much then do you think that we can explain some of the politics in different individual European countries around this issue? Because you mentioned Hungary as an example, a place where we can clearly see an attempt at a pronatalist politics. I'm not saying he's been particularly successful from Orban's point of view, but you can see what he's trying to do. Do you think the attitude that different governments, different parties in Europe take towards population, both in terms of fertility, in terms of migration, does a great deal to explain the divergence in European politics?
Well, I think the pronatal policies in Europe exist in some countries and not in others. And in some countries like ours, we've never had a government in Britain that has said we've got a problem after 50 years of sub-replacement fertility. In France, Macron talks about it. But I don't think pronatal or the absence of pronatal policies is at the heart of modern European politics. What is at the heart of modern European politics is the question of immigration. And there is no doubt that immigration is the result of the indigenous populations of Europe having families that are too small. So the population ages. The population as a whole requires more labour than it has because more and more people are over working age. You can shift the working age. It's difficult to do. Both Macron and Putin have tried to move the pensions age and had a lot of pushback. You can do it, but that's moving deck chairs on the Titanic, effectively. As the population becomes older and older, more and more people are of an age that they're not working, and the ratio of over 65s to 20 to 65 shifts in favour of the former. So we need the labour. And here we are with sluggish growth, and we still have labour shortages despite mass immigration. So there's an enormous pull of migration, both economic, because we're rich and a lot of migrants are coming from poorer countries, but also the sheer demography of the fact that we are having fewer and fewer children to do the jobs that need to be done. And therefore, immigration becomes a major issue. And I think that and the rise of the populist right are the biggest stories in Europe today.
Can you talk about whether there are any successful policies on demographic increasing the fertility rate anywhere in the world? Because from what I could understand you from what you were saying, there are obviously the baseline is how many children you have, but it also matters when you start having children. And those two are obviously linked. But modernity seems to mean having children
fewer later. Can governments do anything against it? It's much easier for governments to get the fertility rate down than up. It's much easier for governments to have programs of birth control, particularly in a society where people are open to that. How do you actually raise the fertility rate? All sorts of things have been tried. People play around with grants, tax breaks. I mean, I suggested in an article in the Sunday Times that people should get tax breaks for having children or pay higher taxes if they don't, and that caused a bit of a row. But there are lots of countries where people do get lower tax rates if they have children,
it doesn't
not
work.
Just benefits. Is it effective? I think it's effective on the margins. I don't think my next book, No One Left, is going to, the penultimate chapter is what can government do? But the last chapter is what can we do for ourselves? And I believe whatever government does is going to be marginal if there's not a cultural change and a change in people's priorities. If people don't want to have children, there'll always be reasons why they can't. Oh, it's too expensive. Housing's too expensive. Childcare's too expensive. Major issues. But if you look at parts of Europe where childcare's very cheap, like in Germany, or housing's very cheap, rural Italy, rural Spain, people still don't have large families. So I don't think anything government can do is going to be sufficient. I think if people understood the implications of rapidly aging and declining population, and they understood the implications for their own lives, and speaking as a parent, if they understood, and a grandparent now, the joy of having children, that is what's needed if we're going to get an uptick.
Can I just play devil's advocate very quickly? But, I mean, I don't know necessarily whether I believe this, but Japan, people seem to have an incredibly nice life there. Are they not just quietly drifting off into old age?
Into the sunset, the land of the setting sun.
But just happily, you know, why do they need to change that?
Well, I think in terms of Japan, you ain't seen nothing yet. So it's only going to get dramatically worse in terms of the dependency ratio, the number of old people. Lots and lots, thousands and thousands of people in Japan die on their own in properties. There's a whole industry in Japan defumigating flats because so many people die with no descendants and the body sits there for months. So the other thing in Japan is the government has a 250%, depending how you calculate it, net or gross, 200% debt to GDP ratio. Now, there are specifics about Japan and the fact that it's largely funded by their own savings. But when we got up towards 100%, there was a bit of a sort of trust meltdown. Are we going to be able to keep the welfare state going without endlessly growing our debt as we age? And who's going to fund it?
I think that these are questions that we've actually talked about in a really different way in relation to our episode on the British economy a few weeks ago, like where is the growth coming from? And this question is very much bound up.
Not coming from anywhere with the kind of population dynamics we're heading towards is my answer.
We're going to return to this question because what kind of politics that there can be in individual countries, but also I think internationally, in a world where growth is difficult for, I would say, for quite a number of reasons, population, of course, being one of them. We're going to return there. But on today's episode, I think we need to stop. It remains to thank Paul very much for a very stimulating conversation. Thank you, Paul.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming in. I've really enjoyed it.
And we've learned a lot, I think.
I didn't know anything about French peasant
a standing start.
Yeah, indeed.
Which is always the way for it to be.
On that note, as Helen says, thank you very much for listening. Please do like and give us a rating and see you next time.
And as ever, this podcast was produced by Ewan Daughtry.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.